Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
One of 6 Feet Under is over, but we're just getting started talking about it here on Post Show Recaps. That's right, it's the 6 Feet Under podcast, where we are revisiting the critically acclaimed HBO series, episode by episode. My name is Ariel, and thankfully, I'm not alone here to discuss the first episode. I'm joined by my co-host, who has such delicate hands, like a statue, or like an illustration from an antique book. It's Amanda. What's up?
Oh my goodness, what a great compliment. I mean, I've been told that only real life is better than my beautiful, delicate hands. Ariel, we're doing it. We're talking about 6 Feet Under. Can you believe it?
I can't believe it. I'm wearing a white sweater, very ghost-like. And I'm so excited to be here to talk about this show that I watched back in the day. Can you believe how long it's been? I literally cannot.
It's been a while. The show definitely shows its age. I feel like this is very much a time capsule of the early aughts, but it's a delight to revisit it. We're going to get into all of it here, starting with the pilot. And people should keep up with everything that we're doing because we actually have our own podcast feed. So please, if you want to come along with us on this journey, go to postshowrecaps.com/6feetunder. Search for Post Show Recap 6 Feet Under in your podcatcher of choice. Subscribing to the podcast feed is a really, really great way to get people to find us and to build the audience and have people in on the conversation.
Yeah, and you should look for that if only to see Tricky's amazing artwork that he created.
It's oh, I love it.
Feed Under, which is simultaneously amazing and horrible, but really amazing. It's great. I can't believe it's there and it's literally under. You can see it. You should go check it out for yourself. It's a spoiler if I tell you too much more about it.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of spoilers, there are no spoilers here. If anyone is wondering, yes, we have seen the entire series, both Amanda and I, but we will not be discussing any spoilers beyond any episode that we're discussing at any point because people are just discovering the show now on Netflix. So, you know, Netflix was really ready to put this front and center on my carousel.
Netflix knew. While it's not safe to smoke cigarettes while driving, it is safe to listen to this podcast if you haven't seen the whole series. Ariel and I will be only discussing episode by episode, so this is going to be a safe podcast for first watchers of the show.
Absolutely, we welcome everyone. So, yeah, let's get into it. This is the pilot. It's just called pilot. It's to your point about the time capsule. That's, you know, that's a tried and true pilot tradition.
Yeah, it was back before people felt like they had to name the first episode of their show. Before we jump into the quick plot recap, like I'm really excited, Ariel, that we're like on this journey. Did you have any initial reactions to jumping back into the show after all these years?
Yes. When I heard the first chord in the opening credits of the episode, my heart jumped. It was like a Pavlovian response to this like super tragic image of just like a bird flying and hands, and it was incredible. And like I always say this, and like I'm really happy, you know, Survivor brought them back. The opening credits for any show, especially when I'm when it's something I really love are really important to me. And this is not something that I will be skipping at any point during the rewatch.
Yeah. The opening credits were so good. The music is so good. This was like kind of before it was in vogue to do like the super brief opening credits. So, you know, it was really, really integral to the show. And it was really nice to see the Fishers again, Ariel. It's like the thing where, you know, you become really attached to characters and they sort of feel like they're part of your life. And yeah, it felt like seeing old friends who, you know, you don't really know why you're friends with them, but they've just been around for a long time.
But and they feel so important to you.
There's some strange comfort in being back with them.
Yeah, this is a family that I consider my family. For as well as you get to know these people, especially the time in my life when I was watching this, you know, as we go through the first season, a lot of emotions, and it's just incredible to revisit. I was struck also by the ratio aspect on the screen, to your point about, again, about the time capsule of it all.
Yes.
I was like, okay, first of all, this is not like quite HD. Well, it's certainly not 4K. And it's more of like a square and less of a rectangle. But yeah, getting back in with these characters right away, it just felt like no time had passed, even though I'm way closer to some of these characters' ages than I was when I first started the show. I was more of a
Claire.
Baby Claire. Yes.
I was a Claire, and now I'm older than Nate is. So it's really great to be back in this world, and to, you know, revisit some of these things that, you know, this was really one of the early prestige television shows. Obviously after The Sopranos made like a huge splash on HBO, this is obviously very different, very, you know, family drama. We're going to deal a lot with like themes that really are out in full force in the very first episode. And I can't wait to get into it.
Yeah, for sure. And I was kind of surprised too. Lastly, I'll say how I remembered it being funny, but like how funny it is right away. Obviously, like a lot of terrible things happen. There's a lot of grief. There's a lot of highs and lows emotionally. And then there's, you know, just like life, it's messy. And there's a lot of laughter and ridiculous situations that these characters get into.
Yeah.
So I was laughing a lot.
And I was so relieved for that too, actually, because as excited as I was to get back into this, you know, the world is a very heavy place right now. And there's a lot of like dark drama on television. And I was like, well, do I really need to do this deep dive into death and the death industry? And I found that like the surrealist elements of the show paired with the humor and just the humanity in the characters made this a relatively easy watch, even though I think that the subject matter can be a little bit heavy.
Yeah, you just breeze through it again watching these people go through something terrible, but I agree with you about the balance. It's just wonderful to see. So okay, we've teased it enough. We're gonna do the quick plot recap. This is the pilot, which premiered on June 3rd, 2001. Wow. Written and directed by Alan Ball, who went on to also create True Blood for HBO. So here we go. First episode. We begin our journey with the death of Nathaniel Fisher Sr., who's the owner of Fisher & Sons Funeral Home, who dies while sneaking a cigarette in his hearse. Wow, what a tease that was, Amanda. He was on his way to pick up his firstborn son, Nate, who has returned to L.A. to visit his family for Christmas. His death, Nathaniel Sr.'s death, rocks the Fisher family, who are plagued with visions of him throughout, some ghostly visions. And full interactions. Ruth, Nathaniel's wife, is racked with guilt over an affair she had with her hairdresser. Nate, again, the eldest son, had fled town. Now he was not interested in joining the family business and instead lives an unfulfilling life as an organic grocery store bagger.
I think he's an assistant manager, maybe.
Yes. Not just a bag boy, as his brother calls him. And he can't seem to keep a romantic partner and has had 4 root canals. He's 35. Okay, I'm 1 year older than that. I've only had 1 root canal. So I feel like I'm doing pretty good. his responsibilities after he left, his responsibilities fell to his younger brother, David, who goes to mortuary school after law school to help maintain the family business. David is also a closeted gay man in a relationship with police officer Keith, who we also meet. Youngest child and key to my heart, Claire, who also owns a sick green hearse, I love reading Jess's words here, mm-hmm. is trying crystal meth for the first time.
Oh,
so innocent.
Oh, honey. Yeah,
it's just a little crystal. For the
not
first
crack,
time.
Ariel. It's not no, crack. A lot of people make that mistake.
No, it's not crack. It's different. And it literally has just taken that first hit when she receives the news of her father's passing. We meet Brenda, who was on Nate's airplane, and they are literally an airplane hookup. I guess this doesn't count as Mile High Club because it happened on Earth.
Nate and Brenda. Better luck next time.
He gives his number to her at the end of the episode. They actually kind of switch numbers throughout the episode. And we also meet Frederico, who is the body restoration specialist who worked at Fisher and Sons, and who we find out Fisher Sr. gave his, you know, gave Frederico his first opportunities, and that's why he's successful now doing what he does. David and Nate, the two brothers, clash over the proper way to grieve. David tries to maintain a cool and very formal veneer during the funeral, while Nate thinks the entire culture around funerals is antiseptic and prefers to allow people to express their emotions. We get a wonderful little Italian, very us and White Lotus, vignette.
My mother.
Very that, except not the voice of these Sicilian women who are like grieving very, very intensely and humanely.
Mm-hmm.
We are, we're sure to see more of that friction as Nate has agreed to stay in town for a bit. And that's where we leave the pilot episode of this wonderful show. I love the tease. Wow. What a great conclusion to that recap. Where do we start?
Oh my gosh. Wow. So, I mean, we're thrown right into this. I mean, Ariel, what was your reaction to having this kind of shocking death so early on? We're introduced to this family. We're introduced to the patriarch, Nathaniel Fisher, and like, boom, instantly he's taken from us.
Well, on the one hand, I'm like, I thought it was the very, very first scene, and then once it's happening, I'm like, oh no, does it have to happen this way? Maybe he doesn't die here, maybe he dies later. Like, maybe my memory is faulty and he's alive for a little more. But no, it's just so tragic because it's such a like everyday stupid mistake that he makes that ends up costing him his life. And you get such a brief glimpse, you know, obviously he has his conversations, but he has his post-mortem conversations with his children and his wife. And, you know, you can argue and we'll, I'm sure, talk about, you know, a little bit of whether it's real, whether it's these people just projecting and that kind of thing. But we do, this is like the only scene we get of him alive is him talking to his wife. And he's obviously very playful and a little sarcastic, and he's sneaking a cigarette and he's lying about it. And he seems like he's a good time.
Yeah. I mean, it's really fascinating because throughout the rest of this episode, we're going to hear so much about him and like all of his children's relationship with him, like especially Nate. And it's interesting that we have to extrapolate from the very, very little of Nathaniel that we actually see in the episode. And it's the conversation that we have between Ruth and Nathaniel like reveals like very much about the nature of this marriage and like these two parents who are at the center of this family. What's your take on Ruth, Ariel? Mama Ruth.
She's very difficult to talk to is my reaction here. She's very quick to like, I can see when people are talking to her how they're kind of, maybe not Nathaniel, him being the exception, because again, he's just so like cool, calm, and collected. Perhaps he should have been looking at the road. The way people are kind of girding themselves a little bit, like, oh God, it's, you know, I don't want to activate her in any way. She's very quick to be reactive to things that you're saying before you're done talking, and the leaps in volume and intensity are very difficult to deal with, I imagine, on when this is your mother or your wife. It's a lot. I'm glad that we get to see her like this, and it's just her being messy, and it's hard. It's really hard to deal with, I imagine.
Yeah. She's like very scolding and like also fragile. Like, you know, she's like calls her husband and she's like, you know, have you done this yet? Have you done this yet? Are you smoking? You're going to stink up the hearse, complaining about him buying the new hearse, saying he's having a midlife crisis. Interestingly, she's going to say, I'd rather him buy a hearse than leave me for a younger woman, and we find out that she's been unfaithful. So maybe that's some projection there, Mama Ruth. But, you know, it seems like, you know, this is a very kind of like repressed and sort of like in ways like puritanical kind of family. And like Ruth is sort of the embodiment of this like extremely kind of anal retentive. Later Nate's going to call her a control freak, and you know that's what's at the center of this sort of holding this up, and we're going to see how like everybody else in the family has maybe reacted to that in their own ways.
It's reactive is putting it mildly, and her reaction, Ruth's reaction, played by the amazing Frances Conroy, her reaction at getting the news of her husband's death is it does not disappoint. I will say that.
Yeah.
She ruins her pot roast, and she yelps and yelps and yelps and is like trying to catch her breath. And then by the time David gets up there to check on her, she has like fully kind of calmed down in the moment and just has expelled all the energy she has, just reacting to the news.
And it's fascinating how she reports it to David. I think first she says that like there's been an accident, the hearse is ruined, like that's the first thing she says, and your father is dead. So it's like that's like an afterthought, and now we have to go with a morgue and identify his body. It's like she immediately kind of represses the emotional reaction and like deals with it very pragmatically and presents it to David. And so that's like on some level, I think, the coping strategy in this family, at least when we're talking about Ruth's perspective and probably also David's, is to kind of focus on pragmatically, what do we have to do? And because this family is in the business of death, they have like this very methodical checklist that they go through.
Yeah, certainly David does. And I obviously he works at the funeral home. So for him, it's so interesting to me watching him throughout the whole episode just be so businesslike about it, in some ways treat it like any other funeral and not really take any time to grieve or lose control until the very end of the episode. But I think that what's interesting to me, what I noticed, was the way that we never actually hear anybody on the other side of the phone deliver the news. Like Ruth gets the news from, you know, either, you know, ambulance, police officer, whoever it is that would call, or then we hear her tell David because they're together in person. But then later when David tells both Nate and Claire, we don't hear the other side of it. We just see the characters' reactions to it. And I thought that was like a really interesting deliberate choice that they made with something that's like clearly so sensitive, just watching like these children, you know, his children react to his death in these different ways.
Yeah. I like that choice. And, you know, for people who are fans of Succession, there is an episode where characters are like getting news about a loved one, and that had, you know, I think a similar, like focusing on the person who's receiving the news, which had a really excellent effect, I think, in both cases in terms of being very, very moving and evocative. I love this like premise of the show, Ariel, just to like zoom out a little bit about what it's like to grieve and confront death for a family of people who are sort of immersed in death all the time. Mm-hmm. And it sort of, I think it's fascinating because, you know, for any of our listeners or anybody who's gone through a loss, and we'll like see it as we go through this episode, there's very, very personal elements of how you confront that, like very intimate emotional reactions that you go through in your own personal grief journey. But there's also like a public element of grieving where, you know, there's these kind of general, like accepted upon rules, or like having that kind of culture of how to handle that helps people understand how to behave. Mm-hmm. And like the Fishers have been in the business of like constantly managing all of that. You know, we hear like David, you know, talk about this is what people want. They want to have like a nice smelling hearse. Like we have this room that we take people into if they start to get upset. Mm-hmm. Like when you're the grieving family, you're in this role of managing your own feelings, but also hosting this opportunity for people around you to come and pay their respects and sort of satisfy their own needs around this event, which mm-hmm. is really, really challenging. And like, that's where people like the Fishers who are in this business come in to help sort of prop all of that up. And there's like this real tension in this episode with Nate, who we're going to see like in his childhood was never really comfortable with what his family did, had his own feelings about death, eventually got away from it. And David, who like quite the opposite, sort of jumped in and tried to follow his father's footsteps and, you know, take over the business, like these two very extreme versions of a reaction to it, but they kind of like represent, I think, a tension within people as they grieve. Like, how mm-hmm. much do I go through the motions to just know what to do next and get right. through the day? And how much do I just stop everything and scream?
Yeah, like what? Yeah, like David does, and that amazing.
Yes,
is every one of our main Fisher family characters had at least one amazing like character laugh out loud moment, and for mm-hmm. me, David's was when he just screams in the middle of the funeral
at the woman who's like going on and on about the music.
Yes, and then before that, it's literally like him imagining he screams, and then later he really does scream. But this dynamic that you're talking about, I agree that the tension is really there, and the episode does a good job of teasing it out and setting up the foundations for why Nate and David would feel the way they feel within their like respective sides of the spectrum as for how to grieve. And I think it's so interesting, like you said, it's true when it's your loved one or your family, there is a sense of responsibility that you have as the host. And then for David's role to be even compounded further as being right. like the face of the business and like trying to put up a good funeral for his father, again, as a business it's just wild to watch him do it. And even when his family first arrives, David, like, you know, buttons his coat. It's very like the family has arrived, but it's like it's your family, and he can't quite make that connection. So I think that says something about the way that he, you know, without putting any value judgments on which side is quote unquote correct, although I do think I would for sure fall on the side of it feeling more honest and open and appropriate to just do whatever you want. We see him not able to do that, and it's sad. And at least he gets, like I said already, he gets his moment at the end to break down. But like for him to be so rigid and so unable to, it's his coping mechanism, like you already said. So they all have one.
Right. And to your point about being the face of the business as well, like one line that really got me was Ruth saying, "We can't have a closed casket. It's like we don't stand by our own work."
Yeah, see, even she is like thinking about, and even early in the episode, right before Nathaniel dies, she's like, "Oh, don't you have a funeral anyway? Like, you should go take care of that." Even though she's not quite involved in the business as far as like its day-to-day operations, she's very much helping him in that way, at least of like reminding him. And she herself is so, you know, kind of indoctrinated in this way of like things should be and all the things that she learned from her husband. And now, of course, her son works in it. So she's propping up that that way of doing things as well, which I think is interesting to then have her kind of be affected by Nate in this episode in a way that I think is positive for her emotional reactions.
Yeah. Let's talk more about Nate Jr. and how he's coming home for the holidays and sort of gets thrust into...
It was supposed to be 6 days of eating his mom's cooking.
Yes, and like sitting on the couch. And you're coming home for the holidays is hard enough as it is to kind of re-assimilate into a family dynamic, especially as an adult.
Yeah, especially when you live somewhere far away and are coming. I mean, I think people can relate to this on all kinds of different levels and, you know, different ages, whether it's like going away for college or you never quite feel the same. Like in some ways, of course, you just pick up like right where you left off, especially as far as like sibling dynamics. But also in other ways, to your point, you're kind of like, have stepped out of this thing and now you have to try to like get in step with this rhythm again.
Mm-hmm. And then amidst this, it's going to be this major family tragedy.
This too.
Nate Fisher, Ariel. I am obsessed with this character. Mm-hmm. This is like a time of the emerging sort of anti-hero. Yeah. I don't know if Nate is a hero or an anti-hero. Like he's so fascinating to me. He's kind of like, he's very specifically like the early aughts. I don't think you would write a character like this now, but he's, you know, he's going to get kind of sized up by Brenda and he's going to be sort of self-diagnosed. He's, you know, that sort of good-looking white man who's like just smart enough, just athletic enough, just everything enough, but also thoroughly mediocre and completely undriven. He sort of like has these ideals, this kind of new age philosophy, but nothing really quite that he follows through with or puts into practice. There was a lot of this going around in the early 2000s. There's still a lot of it going around, but he's such a good avatar for this type of person. And when you were talking, Ariel, about the tension between David's approach to grieving versus Nate's approach, maybe being more honest, at the same time, like while I was watching him, you know, kind of instigate and undermine, the things that David was trying to do. I was like he was kind of being an asshole, right?
That's just his way. That's just Nate's way. Played by the amazing Peter Krause, who I think, you know, was also in Parenthood, but I think this for sure is his most iconic role.
Yes.
Shout out Dirty Sexy Money, which I think is a good show that nobody cares about. And speaking of anti-heroes, you know, Michael C. Hall, who plays his brother David, went on to play one of, you know, arguably the most popular anti, very, very anti-hero, Dexter in that series. Nate, I don't disagree with you. I think a lot of, as with most things, it's a lot about the delivery, right? And Nate comes in with his very, well, just because I believe I'm right, I'm going to, and that is enough, I'm going to now like force this thing upon other people. And while I do appreciate that it like opens this avenue for Ruth to have this incredibly visceral grieving moment, there's a way for Nate to do it and not like be stomping on his little brother's toes.
Right. I mean, it seems like in a way, like Nate is more what Ruth needs right now. And when she asks him if he's going to stick around for a while, just for a few more days, like, you know, I wonder if it's just going to be a few more days, Ariel, or if he's going to stick around longer. But it seems like, you know, maybe she and David are too similar and like Nate is what she actually needs to kind of draw this part of her out that needs to grieve, that needs to open up about her affair, that needs to, like, actually, you know, she's a very repressed person. David kind of encourages that repression with his own sort of repressed nature. And maybe somebody who's a little bit more confrontational, who's a little bit more visceral, who's can actually help her in this moment. So I thought that this was interesting in terms of seeing the family dynamic and how people sort of situate themselves in the Fisher family and what that brings out in each of the family members.
Yeah, and I think it's a good call out that, you know, the similarities between David and Ruth. And I think also just on a fundamental level, David's energy and David's way is what she's used to. So it's just regardless of what approach is, yeah, I feel like even if it was the other way around, there would be this effect of I'm going through something that has, like, completely unmoored me, and this energy feels different than what I'm used to. So maybe this is a better way of handling it. I think, you know, on some human level, it really sometimes is that simple. Although nothing on the show is ever simple. The thing about Nate that I find just so interesting is, or one of the things I found out about him to be so interesting is the way he, in this episode, is running everywhere and can't escape his, in some ways, his conditions, but in some ways, just death in general. Like, literally, we see him as a little kid, like you mentioned in that flashback with his dad in the basement when his dad is, you know, embalming this body. And he runs away and he's like, oh my God, I'm surrounded by death. Then he literally runs away at some point after college, I guess, and never comes back. Or at some point came, you know, comes back to visit probably, but here returns and is still everywhere he's running still when he goes out for his runs. He's either in the cemetery surrounded by death or, like, returning to the site or the intersection where his dad was killed. It's like he cannot escape his family. He cannot escape what his family, like, the place where his family lives, which is all about death. It's a lot for a mediocre person to be dealing with.
No, he's the ultimate example of, like, a character who's, like, running away from himself, right? It's like the thing that is troubling to him is coming from inside the house. Like, he goes to Seattle, where he's not a bag boy, where he's the assistant manager of the largest food co-op, organic food co-op. You know, but he, you know, once he and Claire, you know, where Claire says that he's lucky, he's the one who got away, and he sort of shares that he has a shitty apartment, he can't keep a relationship, he can't even motivate himself to floss. Like, the thing that's nagging at him is within him, and the running, and the fact that, like, you know, we see him trying to escape at all of these points, I think, is, you know, really sort of symbolizing the thing that he doesn't want to confront in himself. Yeah. He does meet somebody on the plane.
What a great use of time. You know, sometimes plane rides are so boring. You know, you can't find a movie you want to watch. Oh, I've already seen that, or I prefer the sequel, or what have you. They only have the one episode from the one thing. Mm-hmm. And you're like, wow, I meet Brenda, who's played by the amazing Rachel Griffiths.
Yes.
And yeah, I really want to talk to you more about this whole shiatsu thing.
Oh, yeah.
he couldn't be any less, like, actually interested in that.
He was very interested in her shiatsu massage career. Yeah, so first impressions of Brenda Chenoweth.
Brenda is, you know, I was trying to see it. It's hard not to see it from, you know, on some level, the way that I was watching it once upon a time. But mm-hmm. like, she's so sure of herself, and she carries herself with this level of cool that is, like, clearly some kind of front, but is just very effective and disarming. And one of my favorite things that she does is quickly lie to Ruth. They're like, how do you and Nate know each other? Cooking class. Like, the way she answers.
Yeah, very, very, very forward. She offers Nate a ride home, and then he says, oh no, my brother should be here any minute. She's like, not that kind of ride. Girl.
This was so clearly pre-9/11 because they found like an open closet at the airport and were just in there like no big deal.
Believe me, this move is not as easy to pull it. totally wild. Like, so I don't know. This whole... Brenda's like a being a little bit demanding. I thought so what happens? So they go in and they have sex in the janitor's closet. Mm-hmm. And this is the scene where Nate gets the call from David telling him what happened.
Thankfully they were finished.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Everybody's getting this news like amidst, you know, not ideal circumstances. But she offers to drive him home, which is like very nice. And then I was like, on the car ride home, she's like, well, let me tell you all about my family. I was like, it's a little bit much. And then when she calls him later, he's really glad she called. And then like, okay, yeah, Nate kind of starts it being a little bit ticky tack with, you know, saying that, oh, you know, asking if her, like, you know, we find out that her parents are psychiatrists.
Yeah, both of them, yeah.
And that her brother has bipolar disorder. She calls it manic depression. And like she immediately starts kind of psychobabbling and analyzing everything that Nate does. He gives it back to her. And she's so rude to him and hangs up. I was like, girl, his father just died.
Yeah, so much for the cool front. Yeah, she does not like to be challenged. She does not like to be called out on her own stuff. And her reaction is very immature. Like, no, ew, screw you. You suck, not me. And then hang up. And I don't disagree about the way she kind of lingers. Like, to be clear, it is very relatable for me, especially, to be like, oh yeah, I would literally rather be anywhere else than with my family. So this is actually a very good selfish activity for me to partake in. But at the same time, at a certain point, you do kind of have to disengage. And like, she goes with him to the hospital. And again, it's like nice that she drove him there. But like, at what point are you kind of just
are you imposing? Yeah, right.
It's
yeah.
Like a private family moment.
Yeah. It's interesting. I did like in the conversation where she says, have you heard of the psychological term progression? And it says, have you heard of the psychological term blow me?
Yes, I think that's in the
it's in the DSM, right?
Four, five, whatever, up to six even. We're probably further beyond than even.
Yeah, we're working on six. That's where we're adding blow me.
Speaking of blowing though, somebody who was taking a puff out of something.
Claire. Oh, that's where we're going.
Claire, I love Claire. I mean, you mentioned Succession. I didn't even realize, you know, the three siblings, one is the redhead. You know, this is clearly proto Succession.
Yeah. Can I say though, actually, so I've commented multiple times about how they couldn't have cast three white people who look less like siblings than the Succession siblings. But I think the Fisher family absolutely looks like a family. Like I really buy it from a family resemblance perspective.
Yeah, something about how pale they all are.
They're all very, very pale. Like, so you can almost see through them.
I would say probably Nate is the least pale, but he's still very pale.
Still very, yes. Yeah, Nate is positively swarthy compared to the rest.
It's all that time in Sicily with his mullet.
There you go. That's what did it. But perhaps the most porcelain complexioned of them all is our dear Claire, played by the incomparable Lauren Ambrose. So she is like, this was definitely the character that I related to most on the initial rewatch. We are roughly the same age, Lauren Ambrose and myself. And this was just like this high school student who, like, just imagining, I think that this was really evocative to me to imagine what it would be like for Claire to have like two significantly older brothers come from this like very sort of repressed family living in a funeral home, like in part, like growing up around all of this as the baby. And then the fact that she's like, you know, her car is a hearse that was a hand-me-down. Yeah. Like what that must do to you kind of psychologically and socially. Yes. I thought that that was really interesting. Like imagining the mother-daughter relationship between someone like Ruth and someone like Claire. And then she's in high school and she's in this crowd and like, you know, this is, you know, she doesn't want to go home and do like the family Christmas Eve stuff. She's already trying to get out of it. She's going to meet up with her boyfriend. They're doing drugs. Like this is, you know, maybe she's smoked pot with Nate on Thanksgiving before, but she's not usually doing crystal, but she's in a crowd and she's impressionable. And she smokes crystal meth for the first time. Maybe it's crack. He promised her it wasn't. And, you know, he says it's just going to make everything burn a little brighter and like perfect timing to get the call that her father has died in a terrible car crash.
Yes. Eric Balfour playing famously non-named character in quotes, Claire's meth date.
Oh my gosh.
Yes, her incredible line read when she's like, oh, I guess this hellish experience that I'm about to go through is just going to burn a little brighter. Thank you.
Really great. Really great delivery here. And it's like, again, like as we're like learning about this family, it really makes like the Nate scene. It makes, I love the way the show does this. It like immediately makes you wonder what this family was like with Nate, because like Claire and, you know, and Nate is going to say this to Brenda, like, well, I guess that like Claire, I don't really know her. So like, we know that Nate had already left the house. Mm-hmm. Like he was like, you know, leaving for college around the time that Claire was a baby. That whatever this kind of like wild, irreverent streak probably comes from their father and not their mother. Yes. That David might be more like Ruth. That despite the fact that perhaps you know, the Nate Senior character had these qualities, he was like tough on his kids. He was, you know, expected a lot of them. We see in, you know, David's like imagined, you know, kind of visions of him, that he's very critical of David's work. Obviously, that's a voice within David being critical of himself, but it like takes the form of his father. You know, Nate says that like, my dad used to ride my ass. Like he, you know, how could somebody who took no risks end up dying in a car crash? So imagining like what it must have been for Claire, like to be in this house, like with just her parents, because her brothers are like older and grown now, like, I imagine that that relationship with her father must have been pretty important to her.
Yeah. And it's really sad that, I mean, obviously she's the youngest one, as we've said, so it's going to hit her differently than it will her older brother. She got less time with him total. And, you know, now it's just, I mean, first of all, on some level, it's like, oh God, now I'm stuck with just David and mom. Like how horrific. Yeah. Sorry, love you both, but
yeah,
apart. And
no,
like
the yeah, scenes, not for me.
the scenes with Nate, I think there's such like economical dialogue writing in this episode, especially like these short scenes that we get with her and Nate, like first hilariously in the hospital when she's like, Nate, I have to talk to you. And he's like, give me a second, please. And then she has to like, you know, selfishly get out this thing that she, which is, I can't say I've ever been there, but she needs to tell her brother right away, like, oh my God, I've, you know, I'm high on this thing. And it's, I needed to tell someone. And he's like, too bad. I have to go identify our dad's dead body. So you need to deal. I'm sorry that you're having like a bad drug trip, you need to deal with it, which is hilarious. But more importantly and more emotional is the scene where she's driving home and then they have their little, again, still hysterically, he's like, pull over, you're driving like a maniac, and her father literally just died in a car accident. But she's like, you're, and this is their moment, similar to when David and Nate have their moment, you left and I had to keep living on. Mm-hmm. And like, you don't even know me. You're not my father. This is what she says to me.
Right.
My dad, like, why do you care about me all of a sudden? Which is so tragic, but obviously understandable because he's just hasn't been around, literally. So
yeah.
Their interactions have been minimal. Like you said, probably a lot of just hanging out at these, you know, whether it's Thanksgivings or Christmases when Nate comes back. And it is really lovely to then get the other side of, okay, let's just go to the store because neither of us want to be here. And we're both kind of outcasts from these two in this family.
And then of course they like get into another fight in the store. I mean, I think that it's, you know, it's impressive to me going back and revisiting like how much I think this show nails the in a very kind of sincere and believable way what these sibling relationships are like. And it's like in like very little dialogue, in very little exposition, like we immediately believe that these people have relationships, have long-standing, you know, grudges and all like everything that comes with family. Like it's comfortable, it's infuriating. Mm-hmm. You know, like it is kind of striking. You know, I was watching this with my husband last night, and like he was just like, he's like, be nicer to your baby sister. And it's like, yeah, in a perfect world, he would be. But it's like the thing about family that I think the show gets right is like the challenge in those moments where like everybody is stretched, mm-hmm. like, and that, and you don't have the emotional capacity to care for each other, much less care for your own needs. And that tension that arises in family units, I thought that this show like really hits that beautifully. And you can see in the dynamic, like just how much taking care of Ruth is like really a focal point. And she's the one who's lost her spouse. You know, she's the one who's lost the person that she built this family with. And like, but it does seem like all of her children are so principally concerned with like, well, we can't stress out mom and like, mm-hmm. oh, you didn't bring the body back. And it's like, well, why did you make mom feel bad about that? And like, right, you know, the right. whole that it does seem to kind of circle around what her emotional needs are. And you can see that these are probably three children like that didn't feel like they always got their emotional needs met by their parental figures.
Yeah. And they don't, and to that point, they don't really even know what that means or what that looks like. Mm-hmm. And it's again, very much like children, even though certainly two of them are all grown up. It's these patterns that you're talking about in families and these habits and the way that, you know, we all have a role to play, even when we're trying to not fall into those same patterns, we inevitably just do. And again, all these dynamics are always complicated, as all families are, but again, you know, compounded by the emotional trauma of losing their father / husband, mm-hmm. and how horrible that is, but just how wonderful it is to watch them all kind of freak out.
Yeah.
At different times.
Yeah. Ariel, did you ever put Elmer's glue on your fingers and then peel it off?
I didn't, but this was something that my brother did a lot. Uh-huh. And I think that was my introduction to it. Like my brother was doing it. So I was like, ew, that's gross. Like, I don't want it. To this thing that we were just talking about, right? Like, yeah. I only had, I had the one sibling. So there was a lot of, at times, since I'm the younger sibling, at times there was, I want to be just like you. And then at other times there was that thing that you like, I want no part of because I need to establish my, you know, independence from you or whatever. So that was one of those things that I did not like the smell. And I just thought it was like disgusting that he was like doing that. But yes, for me, it was a very evocative moment and a memory of me having a reaction to it as opposed to doing it myself.
I love everything about the Elmer. I love the smell. I love the way it feels. I love how gross it looks when it peels off of your face. How it's sort of like you're picking off skin, but it's not. It's so gross. But Claire doing this, I was like immediately brought. I was like, I get you, girl.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I really do.
No, for sure. It definitely, again, stuck out as like a very realistic, real life moment.
And imagine it burning so much brighter.
I was just about to say. That chemical reaction must burn mm-hmm. just that much brighter on the translucent skin mm-hmm. of hers. Yeah, Claire, All I want is to protect Claire at all costs. Yeah. That's all I ever wanted when I was watching this. Mm-hmm. But speaking of translucent children, let's talk a little bit more about David. We've already talked about him and, you know, in regards to the Nate of it all and his dynamic in the family. But outside of the family, he has a boyfriend ? They don't have a label, so we're not sure, but clearly they spend a lot of time together, and David has met Keith's parents, even though, you know, David, as we already said, is closeted and Keith knows no one in his family. And Keith shows up, which freaks David out because it's like, oh my god, my worlds are colliding, but Keith just wants to be there for him.
Yeah, I forgot that Keith gets introduced in the pilot episode. And that's great. And actually, and this was such a big deal at the time, Ariel, like how, you know, because I know that there had been more like kind of queer focused shows, but having like a major character in a prestige show just be gay and have like a kissing scene with his partner in the very first episode. And then I remember there was like a huge hullabaloo about how like Michael C. Hall like wasn't gay and, you know, like, oh my gosh, like he actually can like kiss a man. Like it was like,
wow, look at that acting. Wow,
amazing. But yeah, this is another thing we get that David obviously has, even though he is so buttoned up and kind of repressed and closed fist in his life at home and as a funeral director, like he has this other part of his life where he has a partner. We get in this dynamic that, you know, David probably doesn't usually like do the, first of all, he hasn't introduced Keith to anybody in his family. He's not really going to Keith for emotional support during this time. Like the only reason Keith finds out that his father is dead is because he calls him about their plans that night. So, you know, he has this relationship that obviously he's kept from the family. Like, what do you think about Keith's move, Ariel, to show up at the funeral?
This is dicey. I was going to ask you, but then I was like, I don't know what my answer is. So maybe I won't go there. It's really hard because on the one hand, first of all, you never know how to act, right? And everyone always says there's no right thing to do. There's no right thing to say. You just be there for the person. So this is Keith just trying to be there. But like on some level, there is a calculation there that has to be made. I would be, you know, around these people that he has never introduced me to at a moment where he is, you know, compromised emotionally. And is this going to be upsetting to him? I don't know, because on the one hand, I want to say it doesn't cross his mind that David will be upset. But I think based on his reaction to David getting upset, he totally saw this coming. So
yeah,
I think he's just used to a little bit to what you said. He's used to having to kind of be there for David almost against David's will and be ready for when David does inevitably, you know, fall down, so to speak, emotionally.
Yeah,
he cares about him enough that he's just going to force the issue and not really care one way or the other. So I think his intentions are pure, sure.
I mean, I think he's right that he will need to kind of push David to kind of bring this part of his life like into his family and start to like, first of all, I'm sure that Keith is like has his feelings hurt because he's not, you know, David isn't like kind of honoring their relationship by making this introduction and acknowledging it in this really important part of his life. And I think he's probably also has a good instinct that David needs to have more support than he's going to ask for. But at the same time, it's like, it's not clear at this point, but it seems like David is probably not out of the closet with his mom and sister and brother.
Yeah.
And it's a pretty tall order to ask the person who is like directing his father's funeral on the day after, like on very, like right immediately after his father has died, to also deal with this other thing. And like, you know, and in weird ways, like sometimes those are the time that those things happen, but it feels like it's a lot to ask of him to take on all of that at once.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, to in David's or excuse me, in Keith's defense, it certainly does not seem like he's expecting anything. Like he doesn't want to be like, I'm here to, you know, meet your parents meet your mom and your siblings as a significant other. He just genuinely wants to be there for him. But
they play racquetball together. It's at the same place where they have the cooking classes.
It's just like a community center.
It's a community rec center.
And they have all kinds of activities you wouldn't believe.
They have janitor's closets and cooking classes and racquetball courts.
What an incredible, save the rec center. I think the point about David's character being openly gay and just being, or not, certainly not to his family, but just like living his life as a gay man, mm-hmm. and, you know, that being something that wasn't prevalent on TV, you know, mm-hmm. certainly, again, the HBO of it all, and there had been Queer as Folk was already on Showtime. So this was definitely like of a time with these roles and being written for people to be more representative of the literal world population. So,
and not just like in, like, and just like, I mean, and Will and Grace was also like really huge for representation, but I feel like it was like embedding this like in a drama where it's not the point that somebody, it's like, this is just like a facet of families mm-hmm. and lives that people have different ways that they love and different like identities. So
it's just a character trait.
Right.
I'm really interested to monitor the Keith mm-hmm. situation. The office.
We'll be monitoring it very closely.
I love Claire's react. This is an incredible moment. First of all, when she's like, you know, sitting there with Nate, she's still possibly like day three post hangover crystal, mm-hmm. but it's still lingering. You know, nothing quite hits like that first time. So I think she's clearly still feeling something and she's not quite sure. She's like, am I sweating? But she notices Keith and she's like, who's the cop? And then later she's like, that cop is hot.
It's really funny. And then the whole thing, like, David knows a cop. And it's like, oh, from racquetball. David plays racquetball? Racquetball,
right. After Ruth kind of let the racquetball part go, Claire will not. Claire was like, wait, none of these things are adding up. And the way she just, like, very warmly and casually, in a way, observes this interaction between David and Keith. Instant ally. This is an instant ally. This is instant ally behavior. Her reaction is perfect because she realizes that it's a moment that she wasn't supposed to see. So she kind of like looks down, mm-hmm. but she also smiles because she feels like she understands something about her brother that she didn't know before. And she's learned this new information. And she understands right away that this isn't something that he has shared about himself, but she is glad to know it and is in no way like, you know, upset that she didn't know. It's just it's a sweet thing that she learned, and her reaction is perfect as far as I'm concerned.
It's great.
Maybe she wants to, she's like, this is burning bright enough in this moment. Yeah. I don't need the crystal. This is what saved her.
This is what saved her. This is what brought her back. Ariel, there's a couple of other things I wanted to just like point out in reactions to this pilot episode. Mm-hmm. There's like two sort of surrealist elements in the show. And one of them is the commercials for the various different like funeral accoutrement. What's your take on that as a style choice?
I really think that it primed, because we get one at the very beginning of the mm-hmm. episode. That's the first thing we see. And I think it really is effective because, one, it's like really well done. They're really funny.
Yeah.
And I think they're getting the audience ready for the kind of balance that the show is going to strike between what we've all taught, what you and I have talked about already, in as far as like the humor and the super serious subject matter, but also the way that like death is sanitized in that industry. And it's all about like how things, it's literally about how things look, whether it's the hearse, whether it's the body, what, mm-hmm. you know, the making sure that the scars are, I was going to say healed, but it couldn't be any more opposite than healed. It's like covered up and
exactly.
like concrete paved over almost. And I think it's giving you, it's reminding you certainly that this is, that's like the big driving force of this family's reality, is that they have always been surrounded by death, but in this very like kind of twisted way under the funeral industrial complex.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like sanitized. It's also like the business of it. It's like, it's commercial, it's commodified. Mm-hmm. And I think that tonally, it also kind of like gives you permission to be irreverent about death, because it's like part of the humor and the satire of it is like what makes it manageable. And I think that that's like just a very human kind of coping mechanism to be able to confront something that can be so existentially overwhelming. It's like what Brenda says, like, are you mad at your father? Are you mad because we're all going to die?
That was definitely, yes, absolutely. But that was definitely my moment where I was like, okay, Brenda, you can knock it off now. Like,
yeah, his dad
leave
just
the man
died.
Alone. Yeah.
Yeah.
The man alone.
What if give this psych 101 bullshit a rest, Brenda? My God. Wow.
Brenda, are you upset Brenda. Because she didn't not remind him of death, or that we're all going to die? Yeah.
I'm also a little upset with her haircut, because it's very, very 2001.
Would you have worn her brown like suit blazer outfit?
I wouldn't have worn any of that stuff. And Brenda's wardrobe has always kind of bothered me a lot, to be completely honest.
Incredible.
But yeah, so I totally agree with you about the commercials. It's really interesting stylistic choice. And then the other thing that I love about this episode is the continued appearances of Nate Senior throughout, and like the way that the show like puts him in, like he's going to be wearing like resort wear and sort of sitting in weird places. He kind of appears almost like a Cheshire Cat. Like they make it like, and in different things, like he's going to wear like the suit and the hat in the final scene where Nate watches him leave on the bus. Like, I love that they continue to implant him throughout the show and the ways that they, or in this episode and the ways that they present him. And I love how each of the children has a moment with them where we get kind of a flavor of what their interactions are like.
Yeah, and it was really interesting to me watching specifically the interactions with the various children and how for Nate and David especially, and even Ruth, but you know, it's a little different, but with the three of them, it was like negative, or he was reflecting things within themselves that they are either not proud of or struggling with, and his relationship, or at least his interaction with Claire in that moment, is just so chill and normal and like every day, and just like talking about, you know, the end of how death means like the end of boredom, and you know, obviously it's morbid, but like the end of boredom and the end of, it's just like two adults talking to each other and appreciating each other's company, and Claire doesn't seem to be carrying like that same heavy burden as far as her relationship with him that everyone else is carrying around.
Yeah, and likewise, like the way that she thinks of death, right? Because it's like so many of these characters' relationship with their father is also like this, like it's also this, you know, sort of projection of what their relationship with death is. Like Nate is running from it. You know, David's trying to manage it, and like Claire is almost kind of playful and philosophical about it. And it's interesting how that kind of mirrors the way that they relate to their own father. And I'll call out that's played by Richard Jenkins, who's really, really great in that role.
And having so much fun. Like he can do anything.
He's a ghost. He can do anything.
He loves resort wear. Everything goes back. We did cover the resort.
Oh, yes.
We cover everything goes back to our podcast history together. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I love the outfit changes, and you know, Richard Jenkins just having so much fun, like chewing the scenery in every scene, whether he's like treating his children like crap or just, you know, having a lovely moment with Claire in his resort wear. I love this, you know, we get then at the end this lovely flashback scene that plays over just music, and there isn't any dialogue, and it's Nate and David, and it seems like Claire's not around because she literally wasn't born yet, and Ruth and Nathaniel just like playing around in front of the house, and he's like, you know, playing with the water hose, and it's just such a beautiful moment, but also like a testament to memory and how people would like think of these the moments that you remember. Like there's that one moment where Claire's at the table and she's talking about some memory with her father, and Ruth like barbarically gives her shit about it because she's like, of all the memories with your father, that's the one that you remember. And she was like, that literally just came to me. Like, you can't it's just like normal life. Even when somebody doesn't die, memories just pop into your head. I love this little this quiet, not at all irreverent or stupid or silly moment with Nathaniel that we get of just the family being the family, and you know, one of the few positive moments that they show with everyone together.
That's really beautiful. And I love like your comment about memory, and like one of the things that happens when somebody passes is, you know, I think we make this effortful attempt to kind of go back and curate our memories and sort them and like string together the narrative of their life that, you know, we want to hold on to, or the one that we need to hold on to for whatever reason, because it helps us understand ourselves, and like, you know, taking those, you know, taking a nice kind of childhood memory like that and thinking about the family in that context, I thought was a really great way to end the episode. Before we totally get out of this episode, Ariel, I really do want to shout out Freddie Rodriguez as Frederico Diaz, who's like, so far, I think the only character that we've been introduced to that seems to have the capacity to experience joy. I love him. He's so lovely here. Mm-hmm. Like a little bit weird how proud he is of like reconstructing all of these like horrific corpses. Mm-hmm. But it's like, I think it also speaks to the fact that like he had a relationship with Nathaniel Sr. too, who like took this person in and gave him a chance. And he's obviously very bonded and grateful to the family. So it's just like another dimension of that man's life.
Yeah. And this is someone who comes in on like Christmas Eve or at least certainly on Christmas morning, who has children, who owes this man so much, Nathaniel Sr. And by his own, you know, he decides that he's going to do it. And he's obviously very happy to do it. And like you said, he's very proud of his skills. And I think in his mind, one of the kindest things he can do for this family now is be there for him in what he does best, which is to make Nathaniel look human, which is ironic because the things you have to do to make that happen are so inhuman.
Yeah, you should see what he can do with a severed ear, Ariel. Really impressive stuff.
So the ear has been severed, so like it has a job. It's like an any.
Oh my god, no, that's another show. That's another show.
Yes, no, Frederico, great moment. I love like when him and Nate are just, you know, catching up and, you know, kind of broing out a little bit in a way that clearly Frederico cannot do with
David, right?
At all. And David won't even let him have those moments. He has to be nagging him, like, don't let dad burn, you know, he doesn't say dad, but you
don't let the chemicals, whatever. Yeah.
It's like, okay, mom, like you, to your point of them being exactly alike, David and Ruth, he's very much being like the nagging.
Right. But you have to like imagine that, you know, that Nate Sr. was probably like somewhere in between, right? The Nate Jr. and the David, like he was probably like a bit of a taskmaster about like, this is how we have to do things because he held the business such like high esteem for, like, you know, we find out that Ruth's part of her affair is like they never got to go anywhere together because
her father wouldn't leave the business.
He wouldn't leave the business. So like that is obviously David, like that's part of what David got from his father, is this like absolute dedication to the business. But that, like, you know, Nate Sr. probably could also like joke around with Frederico, like, you know, like
I'm sure they had a very similar dynamic to what he is now seeing Frederico and Nate Jr. have. So it's I don't want that. You die. Yeah. I don't want to feel this way again.
Oh my gosh. All everyone's the family so busy issues.
Feelings, yeah. Right. Everyone's so busy feeling their own feelings and having trouble connecting. It's sad, but like we said, realistic. What a great episode. I didn't know that this was so good. I'm kidding.
We knew. We did.
We did know. And we're so happy that we decided to tell Netflix that they have to put it on their service, and they listen to us, Amanda.
I have to take, you know, I can only imagine that we take some credit for this, Ariel. I bet that the Netflix execs listened to all of our podcast coverage and they thought, what will get Amanda and Ariel back together on a podcast? We have to pull out the big guns. We have to resurrect 6 Feet Under. Yes. We have to dig up the body and we have to put it on Netflix so that Ariel and Amanda will co-host another podcast together. And their prayers have been answered, Ariel. We back
all the way. And thank you to that intern who was like, there's this really old show that I found out about that I've never heard of.
It's yes.
6 Feet Under. So thank you to that Netflix intern who doesn't know that the show is great. I'm so happy to be here talking about this show. And thank you to you for listening, for watching, especially if it's your first time. I am so happy for you that you get to live this for the first time, but also beware and bring tissues. The show's a lot about death, as the show has shown itself to be. So don't miss out. Stay subscribed to our feed. Like we said, pushyourrecaps.com/6feetunder. Search 6 Feet Under, Push Your Recaps. Also, just for Push Your Recaps in general, there's the site pushyourrecaps.com/subscribe. So you never miss anything where we're doing. I think the Netflix people have that link. That's why they never miss anything that we're talking about. Really helpful to get your subs at the start of the season, ratings and reviews too. And if you want the ad-free podcast experience, ooh, the premium embalming package, patreon.com/postshowrecaps. No pesky ads.
We won't be hawking our restoration putty and our dirt salt shakers.
Not at all. That's it for us here. I'm on Twitter at that other Ariel, always trying to retweet what I'm doing. What else have you got going on, Amanda?
Ooh, I am on Twitter at Dr. Amanda R. That's Dr. Amanda R. And I'm also covering Lessons in Chemistry right now with Dr. Melissa Woodward. That's a really fun Apple TV Plus show. Highly recommend. And just, you know, follow me on Twitter. I have some other stuff coming down the pike that you won't want to miss. I'm still covering the Hollywood strikes. The actors are hopefully very, very, very close to a deal with the AMPTP. Like, yeah. That's what it sounds like. And I need them to tie that up so that wrap that up real quick so we can get some more great shows. But you can follow all of that also at the Strike Up the Conversation pod. How about you, Ariel?
So I'm covering, movies every week with Grace, Push Recaps Theater, covering Tales from the Loop with Grace and DM Philly, and also covering The Morning Show, another Apple TV Plus show, which is coming to an end for the season.
Amazing. Well, we will catch up with you for episode 2 of 6 Feet Under.
We're coming back on in a couple of days. We'll be back with you on the 10th. It'll be a Tuesday, Friday release schedule every week. So look out for us then.
Yes. So we'll be back to talk with all of you lovely people. And until then, rest in peace.